Well, good day and welcome back to another episode of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and it's great to have everybody joining us this week. This is our end of the year, beginning of the year episode. I think it's going to end up being a double, so it'll be the one that wraps up 2015 and kicks off 2016 here on the Disaster Podcast. And I think it's important for us to do that because there's been such a big deal about so many things going on in disaster response, from natural disasters to man-made disasters and terrorist incidents and all kinds of things. What can we learn and what kind of things can we do? So we're going to have a group of people that you've heard on the show this past year come back on the show tonight and talk about their personal top responses, maybe from this year or from previous years, and then share the top lessons learned with you, the audience, things that you can take away from you today to help improve your response should that disaster be the next thing that happens in your community. And before we can get to that, of course, we have to talk to our disaster response expert extraordinaire, Sam Bradley.
Hey there, Jamie. God, this is going to be amazing. I put out an email to some of our previous guests and had no idea we'd have this big a party. But the cool thing is these are all awesome people and they're all very different in what they do. So it's going to be really interesting to see how this works. It's going to be fun for you trying to keep track of everybody, but we'll make it work. It's going to be great fun. It's a party, folks. This is our New Year's Eve party on the Disaster Podcast. Unfortunately, our Dr. Joe had a family issue. He couldn't be on with us tonight. So let's hope he and Jim enjoy this when they listen to it. And we also have our regular, you might say, maybe our third co-host, Kevin Ryder, who's our New Jersey transplant now in Texas. And I want to start with you, Kev, because you had a little disaster going on there around the Dallas area. True?
Yeah, apparently Dallas Fort Worth got hit with an EF4 tornado, and it wound up killing 11 people and damaged hundreds of buildings. And a few people, or a few of the buildings it destroyed, were a number of our own responders.
Ooh, I didn't know about that. How did that work?
Yeah, there was one paramedic lost his house. Another EMT lost his house. I don't know the exact number, but the Association of Texas EMS Professionals has already started a GoFundMe project to try and help them out and raise money to defray some of the costs with housing and food and other expenses as they try and do their own cleaning up.
Wow, Jamie, could we put a link up to that?
We'll definitely have a link to that. So, Kevin, if you can shoot me an email, if you have that link, shoot me an email after the show and send me the link. I'll make sure it's in the show notes for this episode. And, this is something we've talked about repeatedly on the show here, is the challenge when responding to disasters in a local area is what do the responders do when their own families, their own homes are put in danger? And we, have talked about that with numerous responders discussing how do you do that when it's in your own backyard and you're worried about your own family or worried about whether your house is coming down.
Yeah, that's scary. You don't hear about it too often, but I was kind of blindsided by this. I didn't realize that it happened to those folks. So I'm really glad to see that EMS agencies are out there, trying to get some help for them. That's the way it should work. We're one big family. So that's really excellent that we can put that up, and hopefully our listeners will help us out there. So Kevin, tell them a bit about yourself I know you've been on a number of water rescues and floods and that kind of thing. What sticks out in your mind?
There's a few of them. I've been deployed in a number of search and rescue missions, dive operations, water rescues. Kind of runs the gamut through all of them. I'm trying to nail down one specific incident. And the one that comes to mind wasn't really anything special or nothing on a grand scheme. It was a very simple search and rescue. But just the outcome of what happened was kind of set in the beginning and comical. A lady went out for a hike in her backyard, or so she thought, and we wound up picking her up a couple miles from home, and she was insisting that she was right in her backyard. And long story short, she thought that everybody who she had come in contact with, search and rescue personnel, fire department, police department, EMS, she thought we were all paid. And when she found out at the hospital that every single person she had come in contact with, aside from the police department, were all volunteers, that kind of blew her mind. It was a Sunday afternoon. It was a nice day. But the fact that we were all voluntarily helping her, putting her needs aside, in front of our personal lives and our family, kind of blew her away. And she left with a different perspective from the whole rescue disaster environment, which was, I thought, pretty good.
That makes a good point. I had a similar experience. The very first disaster I ever went on was when I was a young pup back in 1985, and it was a Red Cross deployment. It was a big flood on the south end of Louisiana, and Hurricane Juan had taken out most of the southern end of Louisiana. And we were down there in the part of the bayou where you have people that don't like strangers. They are very much against that. And it was quite cool at first, but the same thing happened. As soon as they found out we were volunteers and we'd come from all over the country, it made a huge difference. They started cooking dinner for us, and we could do no wrong. It was really amazing. So that's interesting you had that same experience, Kevin.
Yeah, and her whole demeanor changed in the very beginning because she was on the phone with police telling her where she thought she was. Where we found her was somewhere completely different, and I mean off by miles, not just, a quarter mile down the road or whatever. And her attitude was toward us was, I'll say, not the best. She was a little irritated. It took us so long to find her. One of the challenges that made it difficult in locating her was this particular part of the mountain that she was on had a very large iron deposit, which made using GPS and compasses almost impossible. So when we did find her on the way to the hospital, she made a comment. I don't remember exactly what it was, but that's when I let her know that, we're all volunteers. We're here on our own time. We're not getting paid for this, to help you. We don't mind doing it. That's, why we do it. And just a look in her eyes, the change came over just like that. And it was pretty awesome. Her whole demeanor changed toward the positive. And by the time we got in the hospital, she was laughing and joking, and it was all good.
Yeah, it's interesting because I'm in a largely volunteer area in my part of Maryland, and it's always funny to see people transplant out to this rural area from either down from Philadelphia or up from Baltimore, where they have paid EMS and paid fire departments and come down to an all volunteer area, and they just assume that people in the ambulance are professional. And well, I don't want to say not professional, but are paid professionals rather than volunteer professionals. And they are always a little shocked when they find that out, and also very grateful. I haven't had a negative response, when people have discovered that. It's been sort of a very positive experience. But in disaster response, that's often true, and especially for non-governmental organizations that respond to different places and different situations around the country and around the world.
And this particular individual was a transplant from a whole different country, not just a different part of our state. She was in from a different country and had only been there for 6 months. So it was very educational for her. But yeah, everything turned out pretty good.
Wow, that's cool. Yeah, and just about everybody we're talking to tonight has, puts themselves out there. Volunteer or otherwise. And what you were trying to say is, Jamie, is they're no less professional. It's just different. And does it make a difference? I mean, is the level of care any different if you get paid for it? I don't think so. In fact, I think volunteers being out there because they choose to make a bigger difference. That's a whole podcast we could do right there.
I think so. And then, you know, from my aspect, I mean, I don't get the call volume that somebody in some of the larger systems get. And so for me to maintain my skills at a level that I consider proficient requires me to be much more proactive in my reading, in my educational process, in my personal review of things like protocols, because I'm not in there doing it every second of every day. And it might get, you know, I might get on one or two calls a week or even less, you know, when you're in a volunteer situation. So it's a much different setup and requires a little bit different type of discipline from a professional standpoint.
And Kevin said something last week about, what is it, Kev? You try to learn something new every day. You're either reading a journal or, you know, something doing that you might, you know, you're engaging it on a daily basis. Wow.
Yeah, I try and read at a minimum of 2 hours a day just to expand my own personal knowledge. And because of a few of the things I do have such a broad scope that they encompass numerous different disciplines, and everything changes so fast. If I don't read every day, I just moved down here to Texas, so I hopefully will be starting to work professionally in another week or so. So I moved in September, so I've been, you know, since September till now, I haven't been on a single call. I haven't, you know, been on an ambulance or called out for anything. So for me, it's more important than ever that I keep up, because it's very easy. You know, if you don't use it, you lose it. So for me, trying to keep up, I actually have been lately reading more than just 2 or 3 hours a day, just because I'm doing it. And I don't want to be that guy that, you know, first day in the job and he doesn't know how to take vital signs, or, you know, something simple that we just know from doing it all the time. Again, if you don't use it, you lose it. So for me, it's even more important that I spend more time keeping up with everything than when I was writing, you know, taking, you know, a couple calls every single day and actually doing it day in, night out. So yeah, for me, personal education has always been a high priority. Just because I don't want to get complacent. I want to be up on all the new trends and new techniques. And as you guys know from being around me, I always love asking questions to the point where I know I can sometimes be a little bit frustrating, but I just want to know everything.
Well, Kev, we're going to get you to shrink into the background here for a minute so we can get another guest on, since we have a full plate tonight. And speaking of Kevin's...
Not a problem.
We have Kevin Wang, and all I can say about Kevin is he cleans stuff. He cleans everything. There isn't a bug or a piece of oil or a cootie in the world that Kevin can't clean, and he's been on some amazing deployments. And the last time we talked to him, he was working with the CDC on looking at cleaning hospitals. So I want to hear how that went. Kevin, hi.
Hi.
You'll have to explain to them what it is you do.
Well, first of all, we haven't cured cooties. I think that's incurable.
Bummer.
But
my daughters would agree.
Yeah, mine too. But what we did is about 30 years ago, we developed a technology that we call Clean and Capture, and it basically allows us to pressure wash a surface inside the confines of a tool head, like a carpet cleaning wand, for example, if you've ever seen one. And then the outer perimeter of that tool is made either out of short bristle brushes, like a toothbrush, but all the way around, or squeegees, and it allows us to pressure wash a surface about 10,000 times per second per square inch, and then suck up that water as well as any contamination we dislodged. And then over the last 30 years, we've expanded the machinery behind that technology to be able to run any kind of chemistry, be it acids or bases or quaternary disinfectants, as well as any temperature range from ambient temperature to, you know, 212 degrees, and then pressures ranging from 50 psi to clean people or birds or animals up to, we go to 12,000 psi if we want to scarify concrete. And then vacuum levels completely adjustable up to 21 inches of vacuum, which is 2/3 of a perfect vacuum. And then that reclaimed water and contaminant that we suck up goes back to our machine, where we have a variety of different filtration and water treatment systems that allow us to do in situ, or in other words, on the spot, treatment of our wastewater. So, for example, in the BP spill, there was 20,000 companies that were chosen and bidding on the bulk of that contract, and BP chose us and us only. And one of the reasons was our ability to clean things like sand in place without removing it, or boats. And we did 20,000 small boats. We put our machines on vessels, went out and deconned 6,000 vessels at sea. We did about 10,000 fishing nets, some of which were like a mile long. And we did 780 miles of coastline cleanup. And we were able to, using oil water separators in our waste tank, separate the oil out and return it to be sent to refineries. So we created very little, almost zero waste in that whole spill. But we've done things like the anthrax at the Senate, and we did the coal attack, and many years ago we did the Exxon Valdez. So we're basically just real high-end cleaners. We came off of recently doing radiological decon in Japan at the Fukushima plant. So it's kind of what we do and how we do it.
What's amazing, Kevin, is you do so many different things. I mean, you're talking oil, you're talking just every kind of substance on the world. And what I remember you saying in our conversation was, every time you went out with some of your equipment and you worked a different kind of disaster, you learned something new, then you came back and were able to amend your equipment to make it a little better and have it work a little better the next time. True?
Yeah, and sometimes we have to do that during a disaster. Like, there were tools that we had to design and have back in the field within 3 days during the BP disaster. So, like I mentioned, the 20,000 boats. One of the problems we had with boats is they have chines on them. A lot of them will have chines underneath, and that's what they call like a – they basically kind of look like pleats. And we didn't have a tool in our arsenal of attachments that could clean those chines without creating an air gap where contaminants could come out of. So we had to build a custom tool that would clean boat bottoms. And then, you know, design it, develop it, test it, produce it, go back and redesign based on what we saw was wrong with designs, and then retest, and then go to bulk production, and then next day everything down to the Gulf. And we were able to do that in 4 days.
Oh, which, just amazing. You
know, but that's working 24 hours a day. So we solve problems like that.
Yeah, and that's I think something that we heard a lot from you, Kevin, was that this problem solving ability, and it seems to be not unique to just what you do, but it seems to be part of disaster response, in that you never know what type of disaster or situation is going to be presented to you. So you have to be prepared to think on your feet. You have to be prepared to overcome and adapt, and this is what you guys excel at. And we were so excited when we had you on the show. It's been one of our best episodes over the last year. Just I've enjoyed listening to it. I've heard from people, and it's exciting to hear again, even though I know I've heard all this stuff before, to hear again how you've adapted and overcome in these types of situations.
You know, Kevin was, when he was commenting about how he does 2 hours of studies a night to stay on top of his game, I was sitting here thinking that's exactly what I do. So I do about 2 hours a night, and all of our upper management does about the same. And that seems to be the magic number of what it takes to stay on top of your game in a field.
And it makes such a difference. I mean, your people must just be amazingly intelligent and flexible, and, you know, like Jamie was saying, semper gumby. So whatever level of disaster you may work, you have to be able to be flexible, because you never know what's coming at you. Kevin, real quick, can you tell us a little about, because one of the most fascinating parts of that discussion was what you were doing in the hospital, and that was real mind blower. Can you mention that?
Yeah, well, what we were doing was working on doing gross decontamination of hospitals. There was a large local hospital out in California, and which shall remain nameless. And we went through and did ATP testing, and just basically discovered that, you know, large amounts of that hospital basically should have been quarantined. And we stepped back and took a really different approach. You know, hospitals have evolved into doing things the way they do them. And we just came in with a real fresh look for the CDC because we're decontamination experts. So we do, you know, weapons of mass destruction stuff. We do radiological decon, and we do all kinds of stuff. And so we just looked at that very, very differently and saw gaping holes in how hospitals do things. And to us, we were shocked. I was kind of slightly horrified. You know, we came up with a proposal of some things that hospitals can do different that would save them a lot of money and reduce things, you know, like MRSA and stuff like that. But what I walked away with to work on was kind of two things. One was to work with some PPE manufacturers to develop some better personal protection equipment, like gowns, that allow for better donning and disrobing to prevent cross-contamination during that process. Because like during the Ebola thing, 50% of the staff that worked with those patients caught Ebola. And yet they know how bad it was, and they were using the best tools and techniques and equipment known to man. And yet half of them caught it. And that's just how many people were it manifested in them. It tells me that there was 100% exposure. It just means half of the people caught it. You know, that's just kind of a rough guess. But so I want to work on that, and we're in discussion with some makers and stuff to change some of that. And then what we're going to do and began doing, and we're almost done with, was the development of some lights, basically light stands that you can put in a room where you put like four stands, and they're 6 foot tall, and they have ultraviolet light they produce. It's UVC, but really, really high quantities of UVC light, and that basically destroys cell and viruses, kills bacteria and viruses, and that can be a great tool against pandemic type stuff to allow for decontamination of a large room quickly. It doesn't remove the raw biological material, which needs to be removed as well. Otherwise, it becomes a feeding ground for future bacteria. But it does allow for rapid sterilization. And if there were a big incident like Ebola could have quickly have become, it would allow, it would be a prime tool to help defend against that.
One of the things I remember from the episode you did, Kevin, was that you were talking about the difference between your definition of clean and the hospital's definition of clean. You know, they had a certain minimum level of particles of bacteria on a surface was considered clean, and you came in with this completely different definition. What is your definition of when something is clean?
Yeah, my definition is my own, and it's a surface free of anything but itself. So a glass table should have absolutely nothing on it but glass. Stainless table, nothing on it but stainless and the metals that comprise it. That's clean.
Well, we have an ER doc listening out there who's probably wincing as we speak. So
he knows.
He does know. That's definitely, we're going to have some more discussion on that. Thank you, Kevin. That's what you do is truly amazing. And what you, the methods that you're continuing to create are good for the environment. They're good for, not to say that I hope we have more disasters that you're involved in, but it seems like you do good things when you're out there. So we appreciate what it is you do.
Thanks, we try.
A good segue here is a lot of this kind of thing can be translated also to the pre-hospital care environment. And we happen to have Mike Marsh out there. We've had him on the podcast before. He's the operations manager for a very large national ambulance company here in the county in which I work. And he does some other cool things. Something that's unique to Mike is the county that he came from, he created a tactical medical team from the private ambulance company there, and is working on the same thing here, which is pretty unique. Not a lot of private ambulance companies buy into this, but he's made it work, and it's been quite successful. Hi, Mike.
How are you? Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can. So awesome. How are things going on your current venture?
Rainbows and unicorns. Not a stressful day in my entire life. Everyone is working well together.
That's a very Bay Area thing to say.
It is.
I blend with my environment, sir. But I will say that, I'm excited. I'm really excited about this new private-public partnership, things that, that have never been done before, an opportunity to succeed, in a thought process created somewhere well above my pay grade. I'm just really excited to be a part of it. And I've entered into this county where I'm currently at right now and have just been surrounded by just awesome people in labor and in management and fire and law, EMS, and all over the place. And what I thought were going to be major hurdles turned out to be not major hurdles. And it's just a partnership all the way across. And so I'm excited to be a part of it. And times are changing. And I look back, like you asked me, over the last year, and I think, where did 2015 and 14 go in my life? I feel like I took a breath and it was gone.
Well, because they probably have no idea what we're talking about here, but what he's talking about is at the first of the year, very, very soon, we have a brand new type of ambulance transport arrangement, which is a true partnership between this very large national ambulance company and our large county fire department. And I think it's a brand new model that has all the potential in the world. And I think it's new. It'll be interesting to see how it works, but I think it will work. I think times have changed and we have to look at different things. Can you kind of put it that in a capsule a little bit, Mike? Can you kind of explain a little bit about it to the extent that you can?
Yeah, I mean, it's all on the websites and the county websites, but our ambulance company is subcontracting to a fire department in the county, and we're providing services to the same people that we're responding to now, but we're doing it underneath a new alliance between the fire department and the ambulance company that I work for. And we're providing interoperability in the whole county, and between all aspects of delivery of care, to the transports, to incident command systems, to things like, responding on structure fires as a partnership, working with our law enforcement operators in training of violent offenders and active shooter type stuff. And working on water rescue boat patrol stuff, that we did with the sheriff's office, and backing up the fire department in their helicopter rescue program on the ground side, and just really working all the way to the hospital, and then beyond it through the billing sequence of it, is just really exciting new groundbreaking opportunities.
And I think it's the best of both worlds. There's something to be said for what the fire department offers. There's something to be said for what private ambulance offers. And nobody lost in this case. It wasn't as though we were bidding against each other. So one to the exclusion of the other. You're taking the best parts of both of those worlds and giving those to the community. I think that's an awesome concept.
It is. I mean, the chief and the chief executive officer came together and really wanted to. I mean, I don't know about you. I don't think this is a mystery, but we're definitely not receiving more money for what we do.
Surprise.
We're definitely looking to utilize the assets and the resources that are out there now, in a system that had very little or challenged surge capacity. And by joining forces and delivering healthcare in a collaborative way, in an interoperable way, allows us to kind of spread the butter a little bit more evenly and be a lot more responsive to making not only the emergency that we're dealing with right then, but the next five emergencies that are coming down the turnpike. And I think what this contract and this alliance puts together is the first time where, and you've heard me on prior podcasts, is that, you know, it doesn't matter what color patch or apparatus or lug nut you're driving. At the end of the day, it's a patient-centric, really focused delivery. And I think that it's an awesome opportunity. And I'm just, again, surrounded by just a lot of very smarter and more skillful people than myself. And I'm blessed to be mentored by all of them.
Yeah, this is really exciting. And we in the far east end of the county can't wait to see how it works out. Mike, are you also working on a tactical program for ContraCosta as well?
You know, I'm working, you know, with everything going on right now, it's a passion of mine that keeps me going every single day. You know, much like I did in the prior county, is kind of doing some recon to find out where we all are together and where we need to all get to down the road. I think that it's no myth that the acts of violence and the acts of crime that are out there are not decreasing, and that coordinated approaches have proven time and time again to reduce the liability and increase the safety of first responders. And that's something that I've always stood behind, making sure that all of us go home every single day. And that's the passion that I have in there. You know, you put all the, as to coin a great line, you know, you put all the chew, spit, and Velcro off to the side. At the end of the day, what we do is deliver healthcare to not only our brothers and sisters, but those that we need it. And so the tactical medicine thing is something that I want to accomplish with my partners in the new contract, and we'll work towards that. Right now, my sole focus is really just kind of partaking in the active shooter rescue task force concept and preparing interoperability through incident command systems. I mean, we have had to do a little bit of learning in this county that I'm in right now of standardizing ICS, standardizing responses, disaster responses, safety and coordination, communication. So I'm starting at a grassroots level. But yes, my plan of world domination through tactical medicine is in the works.
Well, and as a fire department educator in said county, I think there's a great advantage for fire and private EMS to be training together. And you mentioned kind of the key word is ICS. And in general, across the country, you don't always see private ambulance exactly in sync with what fire does on the ICS side. And so I'm seeing great opportunity with you guys working together to really solidify that and everybody being on the same page. I think that's going to be a great advantage.
You know, subject matter experts are in all facets of first response. And I will tell you that the greatest benefit that we have in this new contract is that those that do ICS so amazing in the fire service are going to be training us in the ambulance industry how to do it even better. And then in return, we get to turn around and we can talk about mass casualty, and we can start talking about, you know, differences of how to better train for triage and so on and so forth. So in and of itself, I mean, just the way that this partnership is built yields itself to cross-contamination, a non-clean surface.
You're going to make Kevin nervous. Yeah, I'm really looking forward to what this will bring. I think you were putting the best of it, all of it out there, and I think it's going to be amazing. And I think it really is going to set a model, set the stage for the rest of the country. Go ahead, Katie.
Right. I just, you know, it's so important with our passion and our hearts that we, when we show up, we're as present as we can be in that moment, and that we don't forget ourselves and our families, to really remember, you know, give yourself the oxygen mask too once in a while, because you guys are right. It is a really frustrating systems to work with. The world is not a perfect place, and our job is to show up and then to remember ourselves too. Have compassion for ourselves.
And John, I want to get back to you in just a second here, but Katie, since we're talking about this, I want to kind of get back on our topic about, you've done so many different things as a DMAT medical professional within the team, overseas on different missions, working with soldiers. And kind of what we're doing here is talking about lessons learned and messages to first responders who might think about doing this kind of work. Or like we were talking earlier, what if you're that guy in the middle of the disaster, like Kevin was saying about what's happening in Texas? What kind of messages would you put out there? You're giving us some good messages now, because the baseline of anything you're doing that's going to create frustration is to take care of yourself.
Exactly. And my list is just so simple. It's show up in the present time, in the moment, meaning if you're really preoccupied with something else, let it go for that response. If you can't, don't show up. Be as present as you can. Be flexible, the Semper Gumby that we all know. Just keep breathing, drink water. Take care of your heart. You know, if your heart's not touched in a disaster response, you're probably in the wrong place. On the other hand, there is a thing called vicarious traumatization, which is a cumulative effect of having too much stress, too many disasters, seeing too many bloody limbs. So you have to find that balance between keeping your heart open and taking care of yourself. So those are my kind of simple guidelines. Just show up, be present, open-hearted, but take care of your heart.
Wow, you make it sound so simple. If only it was. But what you're saying is, no matter what we're doing, you know, what Kevin Wang's doing, what Kevin Ryder's doing, what Mike Marsh is doing, all of the things we do that are different, they're all going to create stress. Jonathan has a lot of passion around communication. I mean, we all have things that are going to make us crazy if we let them. And there's a lot of things we don't have any control over. And we're talking about disaster medicine. We're talking about situations where we have no control over the elements, over the people, over the situation, over the fact that, you know, the hurricane came through and then the levees broke. So those are good lessons. And I'm glad we had you on here, because I think that's one of the most important things that we can remember is, you know, you got to know how to take care of yourself. And you may not have a medical, mental health professional out there to do it for you. You have to know those skills on how to not just take care of yourself. Anybody riding in an ambulance or a fire engine or a police car out there, know how to take care of your partner. Would you agree?
Exactly. And talk to each other. You know, this forum, this end of the year podcast is so cool because we're talking to each other. And we all have frustrations and we can all get each other's backs.
Yep. Even though we do things very differently. Thank you for that, Katie. We all needed that one, I think. So, Jonathan, we're going to throw it back to you because we didn't really get a chance to introduce you. Jonathan, to me, is quite an inspiration. You can see that he's very passionate about things. And he's a guy, and we did a video interview with him. You wouldn't know it by listening to him, but he has Tourette's. And it's something that a lot of people can, you know, find daunting in life, but not Jonathan. He has started his own business. It involves EPCR, which is what he's talking about. He has a family and a new baby, and he's just living life, and he's good at what he does. And I find that he's pretty inspirational. And I remember your story, John, on how you even found out you had Tourette's. That was pretty interesting. You were working in a neuro clinic, weren't you?
I was. And by the way, Sam, your check's in the mail.
You're welcome.
I was working at a neuromuscular, actually, laboratory at Johns Hopkins University, of all ironic places to be when you find out that you have, in fact, a neuromuscular-related condition, I suppose. That was a number of years ago.
Well, somebody told you you had Tourette's, and you said, oh, really? Maybe I ought to go check that out. Pretty interesting story, but you've done a lot.
Thank you.
You have a very successful business now going on in the Bay Area, do you not?
I mean, we're doing okay. There's a little toddler learning how to walk, I suppose, is the way I like to think about it. And actually, ironic that, you know, some of the topics that actually some of the things that just got said, and in fact, woman who just I apologize. Was it Katie?
Katie Amatruda.
Yeah.
So, yeah. You know, I think speaking of inspiration, what you just said is really wonderful, because I think the idea of remembering to take care of yourself is certainly a critical factor. It's certainly one that I have to keep in mind, because the more tired I get, the twitchier I get. It becomes very publicly manifest in that way. But realistically speaking, you know, one of the things that having a disability teaches you pretty profoundly is we all have a cross to bear. You know, maybe that's an ironic phrase a couple of days after Christmas, but it's, you know, but the truth is everybody's got something. And whether it's a company, you know, we like to think we're a small company. And so, you know, everything, we're sensitive to everything, right? We have to be. But big companies, we're small ones too, right? And just because you get bigger doesn't mean your drama goes away. It just changes. And the same thing with people, right? People like to, I don't know, I've been talking a lot with people lately about, I guess because I just had a kid, I have a child who turns 6 months next week, actually, which is kind of amazing. And you know, you start to realize that as this kid goes to school, and we talk a lot about what normal is and how the fact that kids are mean and this and that and the other. And what if it turns out that he has the same condition I do or something else? Mm-hmm. And you know, oftentimes I get asked the question, well, how would you deal with that? And what I would say is I would teach him to realize that everybody's got something, you know, and
you know, Jonathan, you're so right, Jonathan. And it's not only you might get twitchier under stress, but everybody manifests stress. They may get crankier. They may get short-tempered, bossier. We all, sure. Everybody, it's just yours may be more visible in a specific way, but every single one of us and every single human being, when we're under stress, we unravel a little bit. That's normal.
Well, that's right, and I think, especially in, you know, given the industry that we're in, you know, I work on the tech side, so I've seen quite a bit out in the field, but only a fraction of what most of you have seen, and you know, I guess I've often thought that that's one reason why folks in this industry seem to be much more sensitive to the ugly sides of humanity. I guess whether that's mm-hmm. because of things that people do to each other or because they do to themselves or things that happen to them. But the resilience of folks working in the EMS marketplace, and you know, we were just talking about Texas, where we are starting to work in community paramedicine. We are doing that as well here in California, in Alameda County. And, you know, you become remarkably attuned to the fact that, especially in those environments, where you're going out to see patients who may have a mental condition or who may be truly unable to care for themselves and need help so frequently, that sometimes, you know, a hand is enough, but at the same time, the people who are going out into the field and caring for these people, I mean, angels aren't really, I mean, that's not even a nice enough word in many cases. I mean, these are the stuff that you guys see and the stuff that you have to internalize and yet be resilient enough not to go home crying every day. These are remarkable things. I mean, I think there's probably too much compartmentalization that happens in this industry because you'd go crazy otherwise. But at the same time, the idea that you are able to find the good in people and see over time people's lives improving, it's just a beautiful thing. I remember when we talked with our partner clients in Alameda County and they described some of the improvements that the CP program over there has already brought within its first 6 months or so. You know, I get chills down my back just thinking about it. So, you know, I appreciate, Sam, all your kind words about what me and my life, but it's really an honor because to me, this is nothing. This is one person's condition and everybody's got something, but the work that everybody that we serve does is just, I don't know, it makes you, it doesn't make you passionate. It also makes you angry when it doesn't work as smoothly as it should. because you know the work that you guys are all doing is really sacred, and I think that's the only appropriate word for it. For sacred work to get hung up on bureaucracy is a shame.
Thank you, kind sir.
So that's why I said I do what I can, and the joy of the independence is I am that boss, so I don't really have to ask someone for permission to mouth off when appropriate. But at the end of the day, you know, somebody has to, I've often felt that somebody has to speak up for those who can't, whether that's somebody who is disabled and therefore cannot speak up, or someone who has, you know, so much to lose that they swallow what they know is right. And maybe it takes the little guy to jump out in front of those bullets and say, well, we can all be doing better. You know, there seems to be an army of people who are willing to come out of the woodwork when somebody jumps into that fire. And that's been really exciting for us to see.
Jonathan, you're awesome. I'm going to toss this back to Mike just for a second because he has to take off pretty quick. And he wanted to put some final words in there. Hey, Mike.
Hey, I just wanted just to thank you. I'm being pulled in many different directions, and one of them is by 4 children that still call me their father, even through contract implementation. But I wanted to just take a second and really just thank you and Jamie and the podcast network that have allowed me to share some of my worst moments and hopefully some good decision making during those moments. But the reason for that is because there are people like you and your organization that really, really plug the incident command system, the training of interoperability, and the patchless and seamless response of delivery of care. And I really wanted to take a moment and tell you how valued that you both are in this community. And I hope that we'll hear a lot more from you. And I hope that, I don't ever hope that I have a lot more disasters. I enjoy mitigating them, but I don't want to have a lot more. But I definitely know that that you guys are responsible for the success of many disasters that are out there because you're pushing the education. And thanks to people like you that people like me don't continue to screw up on a daily basis.
Wow. Well, I'll take the money Jonathan's sending me and send it to you. So we really appreciate those kind words. And
we
want to get back. We want to get back to you, Mike, as things go with the Alliance, to kind of hear how it's going and see what wonderful things you guys are doing out there. So we'll be in touch, certainly.
Wonderful. Thank you, everyone. Thank you, Jamie. And I'm going to drop off.
Thanks, Mike.
We have someone who's been lurking in the background. I saw something slide by earlier about Missouri, and it so happens we have Dr. Brian Froelke, again, a good friend of mine. I don't think I mentioned him here because he's been in the background, but he's been hiding in a meeting listening to the podcast, which I think is pretty funny. But he is a DMAT doc. He's also the state medical director for Missouri. He's involved in a bunch of different things. I don't know. Maybe he can come on and give us kind of the 30,000-foot view of everything we're talking about. And one thing that he was very involved with was the Joplin tornado. And I was right with him on that, at least from afar. You out there, Brian?
Yes, I am. Thank you.
Able to make it in.
Yeah, I'm glad I could sneak off. So I was just listening in, and as you mentioned in the background, and one of the things, especially as we wrap up the year, that I was pleased to hear is the focus that everybody had on the people surrounding the disaster, medical responses and the disaster responses. Everything from taking care of yourself and recognizing the amazing people who work in the disaster environment and the many skills that they bring, many times volunteer and many times at tremendous expense to themselves and their family, and with regard to stress and everything else. So really amazing folks that I had the opportunity of working with in the pre-hospital disaster environment. And I'm glad that everybody's focusing on that because it's a great area. I'm, of course, a little biased because I just celebrated the anniversary this month. I met my wife at a disaster at one of the hurricanes. I think it was Hurricane Ivan where I met a mental health specialist. I was the team doc, and we both independently went to the commander and decided that we were not going to engage in a professional relationship from day one of that deployment. And several years later, we're happy to be interrupted occasionally by the two little ones running around here somewhere.
Well, that's the perfect family. You've got the right balance there.
Another area that I was thinking that you were talking about in ways is the stress and taking care of yourself in disasters. And I've certainly seen my share of the disasters. But one area that I'm currently focusing on that I'm hoping to make some improvements on is the recognition that when you take people out of their normal environment where they normally practice medicine, and you give them different formularies, different doses, potentially different patient population than they're normally taking care of day in and day out, and you reduce the amount of resources they have, there's a tremendous amount of risk for medical errors and certain things that when you do have a full night's sleep and you do have everything if you're ready and you can look things up on the internet and so forth, there's always a chance that we might change and tweak some of the things that we do on the fly. And I think that there's an awful lot of lessons learned and an awful lot of benefit for being able to share some of those experiences. Sometimes very difficult for medical professionals to share some errors and so forth that can occur in the hopes that we can prevent some of them in future disasters, and especially in certain rare instances, create some systems and ways in which we can predict where we might be at risk and further reduce some of that the stress and the risk associated with that. So that's one of those areas that I'm working with a group, a patient safety organization in Missouri, who is looking at the pre-hospital environment and a way in which we can work on protected environments to discuss in a HIPAA-compliant and patient-protected environment some of these stories so that we can get at some of those areas where we might be able to improve the system and reduce some of those errors.
Wow, that's awesome. And one thing we have to give the federal government credit for is on so many different levels after a major disaster, they really look at after action reports. I know working in the EPCR arena of that and training in their medical data collection program, they really do take the input from the field on what worked and what didn't work. And I'm sure on just about every level of a disaster, they really do listen to the feedback from the field on up and look for those lessons learned so they can make it better the next time. So I think what you're doing is an awesome idea, Brian. I hadn't heard about that. I can't think of any equivalent to that. I haven't heard of any. So that's a program you have going on right now in Missouri?
Right. So currently in Missouri, we have a patient safety organization that's focused on the pre-hospital environment where we help build bridges between the multifaceted different types of folks that are working in the pre-hospital environment, everything from the hospital to the fire agencies to the private or hospital-based ambulance services. Everybody who has the opportunity of touching the patient many times can't really discuss the patient care in a protected environment where they can improve in a system fashion, the care that's being provided to those folks. And so what we're doing is trying to break down some of those walls by providing a little bit of a level of protection across those, that crosses those gaps. And then we're in working on ways, once we have that working well in the EMS world, then there's obvious parallels to the disaster environment where you have some events that are either mass gatherings or true disasters, where we can get some of those lessons learned and kind of drill down on more specific types of care practices. You know, one example would be medication dosing, taking a look at, you know, what we do in the emergency department, where certain types of medications require somebody else to take a peek just to justify or to show that you really are giving a dose that you think you're giving. In a disaster environment, do you use that tool for certain dangerous medications where in daily practice you might not? Some of those types of things that we're looking at.
Well, and not, you know, what you were saying earlier too, in a disaster environment. So first of all, and what I'm thinking when you're talking about this is I think it's a lot harder for hospital-based personnel who are in a very controlled environment, well-lighted, warm, you know, controlled environment versus pre-hospital. So I think in sense. Pre-hospital people probably find it easier to transition to a disaster environment where things are less controlled, where you take somebody, whether it's an ER doc or a nurse, out of their ER and stick them into a disaster setting. I think the stress level goes up astronomically because you don't have all your people. You don't have your controlled environment. You don't have all the safeguards you're used to having. So it probably really does predispose us to making mistakes. But finding a place where people can discuss these and bring them out into the open so they don't happen again is a stellar idea. I think that's awesome what you're doing.
Well, hopefully we'll get it all worked out. Certainly it's in some of the beginning stages, but once we have some things ironed out and we have some opportunities to invite some teams and so forth to participate, I'll let you know and we'll chat more about it.
Please do. We'd love to have you get back on when you could tell us a little more about how that's going. That sounds like an awesome program, and
absolutely,
we're glad you were able to sneak in. What do you think, Jamie?
I think it's great. And Brian, thanks for taking some time out of your busy schedule to be on the show. It's been a while since we've chatted with you, so it's great to have you on.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It's always good to be here.
You know, Sam, it brings us back. We've talked about a lot of topics, and it always seems to come back around to, you know, getting the proper education. The we talked earlier about professionally managing our time by finding time to read and remain current on the data and the research and things like that, and good training, and we couldn't do this show, and we would be so very remiss if we didn't talk a little bit about our sponsors, Paragon Medical Education Group. Joe couldn't be here tonight, Dr. Joe Holly, but they make it possible for us to put this show out here and to do this program. And we're coming into the end of our second year, and they're committed to supporting us into a third year, and that's fantastic. So if you're looking for a unique program of education and training and support that will give you something much different than the typical death by PowerPoint that you're used to getting in your system on preparedness and training and things like that, you really need to get in touch with them over at ParagonMedicalGroup.com, or you can find them on Twitter at ParagonMedEDU and also on Facebook. So just look them up. You can find links to them over at DisasterPodcast.com, where we have them linked prominently on the site. But you should reach out to them, find out what it would take to get them to come into your system and bring some of their unique stress immersion training programs to help prepare you for the next disaster that could be just around the corner for your system. And it could make the difference between saving lives and also saving responders. So I hope you'll consider that. And Sam, we have to make sure we say thanks to them, because we couldn't do this show and have all these fabulous guests on without them.
I know, and I really miss the fact that they couldn't be here tonight. So I give this show to them as our gift to celebrate the end of our second year, and I'm really excited about going into year three with them. And God, I mean, I think you said it before, whenever we thought we'd run out of things to talk about, there's something new out there. There's a new disaster, unfortunately, and I hate to think that, you know, that's helpful, but it is. And there's always something new to talk about. Everything we talked about tonight, I want to get all of these folks back on this next year to talk about the different projects they're working on, and who knows what else is out there. I'm sure.
Yeah.
It's scary to think the topics that we don't yet know about, the disasters that are yet to occur, that we'll be talking about this next year. But you're right. Without Jim and Joe and Paragon, we couldn't be doing it.
And, you know, folks, we'll have links to the episodes that all these folks were on. If you liked what you heard them talk about a little bit and you want to hear a little bit more about what they do, we'll have links in the show notes for this episode. Actually, it's going to be a double episode. So the last episode of 2015, the first episode of 2016, check out the show notes for links to our guests and their episodes here of the Disaster Podcast, as well as their individual projects and connection links. We'll have all of that for all of them. So I just want to thank all of our guests, and I'll just run down the list here. We've got Kevin Reiter, Katie M. Atruda, Kevin Wang, Jonathan Fight, Brian Frelke, Dr. Brian Frelke, and Mike Marsh. We couldn't do this show without fabulous guests, and we couldn't do it this particular episode without these particular guests. So thanks, guys, for being on. Ladies and gentlemen, we couldn't do it without you.
It just shows the diversity.
Jamie.
And then you get people like Katie who are going to hold us together no matter what we're doing or what our frustrations are. I love you, Katie.
Right back at you, Sam.
So, Sam,
so glad you're
there. Thank you, Ronald, and thank you, Jamie.
Thank you. Thank you. And, you know, Sam, this show is again, underlined some of the key things we've talked about since day one of this podcast about disaster medicine, about managing both the response and the responders, managing the patients and their families, managing the individual situations and our resources. It all comes back to our central thought point for this show.
And if any episode we've ever done explains it, this one certainly does, that disaster medicine is not your everyday medicine.